In today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, protesters at the Port of Oakland picketed an Israeli cargo ship, and international longshoremen chose not to cross the picket line to unload it.
Whether it's the Vietnam War, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, or Israel and Palestine, the Democrats and Republicans have the same party. That's why I've always fought for in the Longshore Union that we break with the Democrats and form a workers' party in this country.
Former Democratic Party Chair and President Obama's Secretary of Labor, Tom Perez, has moved on to join a union-busting law firm.
It's going to be like a part-time role. It says on his bio that he'll be working on like the legislative and government affairs team. The easiest way to process that is that it's like a fake lobbyist job, the kind of, you know, pseudo-consulting job that former government officials will take where they don't have to register as a lobbyist, but, you know, they're basically helping facilitate, you know, influence peddling for corporate clients.
Namibian uranium miners fight healthcare cuts and union busting by the Chinese National Nuclear Corporation.
With the Chinese, they don't want to resolve. They don't want to come to the table. What they do, they rather send you threat letters. And this is what they've been doing. In fact, one of the things that they've done, the first thing they did is try to bribe. In several occasions, they tried to bribe me personally.
Ethiopian government spokeswoman Billene Siom accused critics of demonizing Ethiopia with an ulterior agenda.
With this continued provision of food assistance, the global claims of hunger being used as a weapon of war are baseless and politically motivated. Ethiopia is witnessing an orchestrated attack that is condescending in nature, often patronizing in tone, belligerent in approach, and destructive in outcome. It is disingenuous to hijack the suffering of ordinary citizens for other goals.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network. I'm your host, Vinisha Patel-Adams. On Friday, June 1st, hundreds of protesters converged on the port of Oakland's Berth 30 to keep a cargo ship chartered by Zim Integrated Shipping Services, an Israeli corporation, from unloading. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with them about why they were protesting and with members of the International Longshoremen's Union about why they respected the picket line.
Jack Heyman, I'm a retired longshoreman, a veteran of the class struggles on the waterfront. This ship is called the Volans. It's chartered by Zim Lines, and she's bringing in cargo from China. What these ships are doing here now, there's a 10-year contract with Amazon to bring in goods that are made in China to the U.S. for Amazon for 10 years.
That's a big contract.
It is, and they're chartering ships. This is a Zim chartered ship, the Volans, that's in here now. And the picketers are stopping longshoremen from working it. But we don't want to just stop the Zim ships in the port of Oakland. This needs to spread up and down the West Coast. From Los Angeles and Long Beach, the two largest ports in this country, up to Seattle and Tacoma as well. And if we can do that successfully, then we need to appeal to dock workers around the world. In Italy, they're already taking action against Zim ships. The Zionists have to know that when they commit these genocidal attacks against the Palestinian people and so many children being killed, that there's a penalty to be paid. And we're going to stop these ships as much as we can around the world. This should be a message to dock workers around the world to join us to send a message to the Zionist government of Israel that we will not be quiet. We will not be silenced when they attack the Palestinian people like this.
What's the position of the ILWU and the ILA, two major unions representing dock workers on the West Coast and East Coast?
The position of the ILA on the East Coast, they represent longshoremen on the Atlantic coast and also in the Caribbean, in the Gulf. And so they've always supported Israel. They've always supported every U.S. imperialist war. We need to appeal to them to stand with us. This is no different than striking against the apartheid government of South Africa. We did several strikes against the apartheid government.
In 1984,
and after that as well. And also longshoremen on the East Coast did have strike actions against the apartheid government. We need to appeal to the longshoremen on the East Coast to join with us to send a message to the Israeli government that we will stop your ships if you continue to oppress the Palestinian people.
So you don't agree with this two-state solution?
No, it's not working because since the Nakba in 1948, Israelis have been increasingly encroaching on Arab lands, stealing the lands, and it's led to continuous war since 1948.
The Democrats and Republicans seem to think that Israel should be supported. There's $875 million that, including Bernie Sanders, are supporting. Why is the Democrats and Republicans supporting Israel?
Both parties have the same foreign policy. There's really not a difference in the Democrats and Republicans when you come to foreign policies, whether it's the Vietnam War, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, or Israel and Palestine. The Democrats and Republicans have the same party. That's why I've always fought for in the Longshore Union that we break with the Democrats and form a workers' party in this country that's going to oppose imperialism abroad and win the war at home against the employers.
Is there any hope of that?
Well, people are going to be disenchanted with the Biden administration, in my opinion. The Democrats really have offered nothing for the working class. We had a big strike in the Northwest just a few years ago. What did the Obama-Biden administration do? They sent in armed Coast Guard cutters to protect the scab ship. I mean, the Democrats call for support for them. At the same time, they're breaking strikes against the trade unions. So we need to form our own party in this country, a workers' party that's going to fight for workers' interests.
Kinza, and I'm here today because what's happening with the Palestinians is just deplorable. And I think it's high time that we make a statement. And one of the biggest ways to make a statement is by monetary effect. And so hopefully this will send a message to Israel that U.S. is not going to be doing business with them any longer. And hopefully we can send a message to our representatives that we want change to happen. So hopefully our tax dollars will stay in the U.S. where they are more needed.
The United States is giving a lot of money to Israel.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
It drives me crazy. As a teacher, I think we could use the money in our education system more than we could in supporting wars overseas where, I mean, it's not really a war, right? It's like you're just killing people. I mean, again, it's genocide. It's basically, call it what it is, you know. You're ethnically cleansing a peoples and you're purposely targeting them. And, I mean, these people are dying and nobody's doing anything about it.
So there is something happening here.
What? Right, which is why we're here today, right? Is to shine light on this and hopefully make an impact.
My name's Priya. I'm here today to block the Zim ship because I think that the flow of capital is inherently linked to imperialism, and when we stand together and stop that from happening, from normalizing globalization of Israeli products, especially weaponry, then we can win and liberate ourselves and all oppressed people.
It seems like it's a big business in the United States, selling weapons to Israel, selling weapons all over the world. You think that should stop?
Oh, 100%. It's extremely normalized. Our tax dollar funds that. So tacitly, we're giving our consent to the slaughter and the mass murder that the U.S. Helps enable and what Israel is doing in Gaza and all around Palestine. So, yeah, liberate Palestine, free Palestine, all of it. Return the land.
Are you urging other people around the country and internationally to stop shipping?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that there are several actions actually going on at all the port cities so that, you know, it's not just Oakland, but all around the United States, port cities. So, yeah, I would definitely encourage more folks to come out. And I definitely oppose the unloading of the Zim ship. Yeah.
Anthony LeVage.
So, Anthony, you're a longshoreman. What's going on here today?
Picket of the Zim ship. Longshoremen are standing by. They're not going to cross the line. Have I seen the picket before? In 2014, we had the same issue of blocking a ship from from Israel or a Zim ship because of the occupation and the escalated violence over there. I've personally been to Palestine, I think maybe three years ago, and I seen with my own eyes of the stealing of the land, the treatment of the Palestinian people. I mean, all the checkpoints, how they live in different places, how you can have a Palestinian community and a Jewish person to move in, then they got to get escorted. It was sad, but it gives me a modern day look at how this land in the U.S. was stolen by the British and the Americans. You know, it's just, you changed the name of it. You know, back then it was like, it was savages. You know, now they're terrorists. You know, you got to create these demonized people as you take land. So that would be my personal opinion, my experience of what I seen when I went over there.
Some people say that the ILWU, the union, should not be involved. You have a different point of view about labor?
Not just the union, like working class people should be involved. I mean, the same people who are doing this in Israel or automating the ports or whatever, or these wealthy group of people are doing things for profit, it affects all of us. So I think all working class people should be involved in wanting something different for the next generations.
My name is Tatiana Brown. I'm a Jewish person with Holocaust survivors in my family. The German government actually paid my family reparations, novel idea, I know, until my great-grandmother died at 98 because we lost so many people in the Holocaust. And I think that using the threat of genocide against Jewish people is a nightmarish and deplorable use of whiteness to excuse violence against children and families and people who deserve to live in their homelands. And it is, I find it just horrifying that the suffering of my family is being used to justify the suffering of millions of people and to create an apartheid state in the Middle East. I don't think it is acceptable for us to deputize ourselves as white folks in an area that has people who've lived there for centuries. It is a much more complicated issue than just having the UN and British imperialists draw a bunch of lines on a map in like 1948. And it's stupid that we're justifying the cruelty against people who are just trying to live. And I cannot live with that being done in my name or in the name of my family.
Larry Wright, the retired longshoreman, Local 10 and Local 91.
And Larry, you've been involved for many years, including the fight against the apartheid regime. Why don't you talk about some of that history and its connection today?
I see the struggle today in Palestine is very similar. I was involved in the civil rights movement in this country. I went to Mississippi in 1964, and I've seen the racism in South Africa is very similar to the racism in Jim Crow that existed in this country. So I got involved, worked with an organization called Liberation Support Movement, and we supported liberation struggles in Mozambique, Angola, South Africa, Zimbabwe. I went to Africa for 3 months in support of the popular movement for the liberation of Angola. And so I had a lot of experience in working with African people in revolution. And so we formed a committee in Local 10 called the Southern African Liberation Support Committee and started doing support for the people, the workers, especially in South Africa. We raised material support, but most importantly, we politicized people. We educated people about what was happening there so that when a vote came up in Local 10 to discharge a ship that had South African cargo, it passed, I think, unanimously, and we were able to stop a ship for 11 days, and it galvanized a big coalition of groups, including the church groups, the labor community, the gay community, just all kinds of people who were understanding students of what was happening there, and it was very effective. It was thousands of people that went on and played a role in apartheid eventually being abolished in South Africa in 1994. So now I see this struggle is very similar. In South Africa, they pushed people off the land. Blacks were forced into some of the worst land where they couldn't really even farm and support themselves, so that people were forced to go into what was called South Africa. What's happening in Palestine is very similar. People are having their land stolen, their houses stolen. There's a lot of violence against Palestinians. It's been particularly bad here just recently. And I see it as a form of apartheid and a form of genocide, the way that Palestinians are being killed in this struggle. And I don't think that the Israeli government has any thoughts of a peace settlement. I think that they're just slowly pushing the Palestinians away. It's just that kind of terrible situation that existed in South Africa, and it's happening in Palestine now.
Trent Willis, I'm the president of the ILWU Local 10.
Pick it out here today, and the ILWU members are standing by. And you're not going to cross that picket line.
I wouldn't recommend our members to cross a picket line. First of all, it goes against our 10 guiding principles. Second of all, we're not the troops for the corporate bosses, so we're not going to fight through protesters for them. You know, we have the right to work in a safe environment. It's in our contract, and it's the employer's responsibility to make sure that that environment is safe. For there to be any insinuation or any thought in anybody's mind to try to get us to fight through a picket line is crazy, because we are labor. We're not the employer's defense force, okay? We're the workforce. How many black people have to get shot in the back of the head, you know, chased down by vigilante citizens, okay, and killed before the George Floyd Act is passed? You got the reparations bill. It's not even to give black people reparations, it's to explore it. We can't even get that passed, okay? You have the anti-lynching bill. How can you not pass an anti-lynching bill? How can you not be against lynching, okay? That is a huge problem. So when you come down as a representative of corporate America or whatever you want to call them, and you talking to black and brown people, and you telling them you want them to cross other black and brown people who are having similar, very similar things happen to them, and in particular when it's not even that's not our job. We're not the police of the port. We are the workers of the port. Okay, you can't put that kind of pressure on labor. The people who are exercising their rights out here today, those are working people also. We have 10 guiding principles that we follow. We intend to follow them. Okay, so the employers and corporate America can try to shape any kind of scenario or story that they want. Okay, this is what it is. You have people out here exercising their rights, and it is not the ILWU's job, or it is not in our best interest for safety reasons and every other reason to challenge these protesters. We as a people are not the only ones telling the truth, because this demonstration out here, this is about the truth. This is about people trying to protest so that the truth comes out. People shouldn't have to protest for the truth to come out. The truth should be told from the get-go.
And end the occupation! Free, free, free Palestine!
The picket was successful, and on Friday evening, the cargo ship chartered by Israel's Zim Integrated Shipping Services left the berth without unloading. This is the first labor solidarity direct action by U.S. workers since 2014, when longshoremen refused to cross a picket line to unload Zim cargo. The ship's next destination is unknown.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Tom Perez, President Barack Obama's former labor secretary and the former head of the Democratic National Committee, has decided to join a union-busting law firm. Arnie Arneson, host of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson on Pacifica affiliate WNHNLP in Concord, New Hampshire, interviewed writer Andrew Perez about Tom Perez and his new line of work, union busting.
I'm looking at an article by Andrew Perez. He's a writer and researcher living in Maine. And this piece was actually reproduced in a couple of publications. The title of it was Obama Labor Secretary Tom Perez Just Joined an Anti-Union Law Firm. So let me welcome to the program, Andrew Perez. The sense of disappointment is overwhelming. So welcome to the program and tell us the story of Monsieur Perez.
The story is, on Thursday, Tom Perez announced that he's joining the law firm Venable. You know, it's not entirely clear what he'll be doing there, but both his firm bio and the press release make kind of clear he'll be working on some of the same issues he had been previously as the Obama labor secretary. But, you know, one of the things that's really kind of astounding about it is that it's going to be like a part-time role. It says on his bio that he'll be working on like the legislative and government affairs team. The easiest way to process that is that it's like a fake lobbyist job, the kind of, you know, pseudo consulting job that former government officials will take where they don't have to register as a lobbyist, but, you know, they're basically helping facilitate, you know, influence peddling for corporate clients. You know, at the same time as he's taking this job, he might actually run for governor in Maryland. Like, he's been actively prepping a run there. It's sort of not clear whether he will or not. It looks like he's said that, or his team has said he'll decide by next month. But yeah, he might actually run for governor, you know, a month after taking a job at an anti-union law firm.
Let me sort of confess to you. I ran for governor in the state of New Hampshire in 1992. So I lose the race and I got more votes than any Democrat in history, but I still lost the race. All right. What was so shocking to me was the number of people that approached me to work with them. One of the top lobbying firms called me to work for them. So it is not uncommon for these companies to reach out to you and say, join my firm. What is so depressing is how many people say yes, okay? I mean, I'm not surprised that they got knocked on the door, but I'm more surprised at Perez, especially if he wants to run for the governorship in Maryland, because the story that you tell in your piece about this firm is not exactly credentialing for a Democrat, all right? Especially when, you know, you want to run in 2022, which is, by the way, next year, you know, and given what Joe Biden is trying to do and given Tom Perez's history, not only as DNC chair, but as the hell labor secretary. I mean, he looks like, you know, where are his core values and where is his compass?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, in the press release from the firm, he says that he's always, you know, worked to fight for workers and, you know, lived his values and stuff. And yeah, it's definitely kind of stunning to then, you know, say all that in a press release where he also says that the attorneys there help clients navigate, you know, regulatory policy and labor and employment issues. And he looks forward to joining them in this important work. It was definitely a pretty stunning decision. I mean, I guess one of the things here that you might count on is just lack of news coverage. Like, you know, we are one of only like a very small handful of outlets that have reported on this at all. It was not national news that the former DNC chair, who only left in January, is now working at a corporate law firm. It's just, I think at some level, people in Washington, including the reporting press, are just desensitized to this kind of thing and just don't think that it's news because it happens all the time.
Well, as you put in your piece, and let me just remind everyone that unfortunately Perez is just one of the conga line of Obama people that have gone to work for the other side. And what you write in your piece is Perez, who is the Democratic National Committee chair until January, I mean, remember this, January, that's like January 2021, joins a growing number of Obama officials who cashed in their government experience with jobs at union busting companies. That list includes press secretaries Jay Carney, who became the top flack at Amazon, Robert Gibbs, who spent several years as a top flack for McDonald's, Obama's senior advisor, David Plouffe, served as policy chief at Uber, while former senior advisor Valerie Jarrett has a board seat at Lyft. What bothers me about all this is that you're right. We have so much on our plate. We have Donald Trump. We have the insurrection. We have voter suppression. We have the pandemic. And yet, in the end, these are important stories. because they're important stories that I think as a progressive liberal Democrat, I want to know about, because the thing I hate the most is the revolving door. The thing I hate the most is that when you sort of package yourself as a progressive and then seconds later sell out to a union busting company is just even more outrageous. And frankly, my dream is someone ask Joe Biden what he thinks of Tom Perez, what he thinks of that decision, because you mentioned the firm he joined. It doesn't just talk about union busting, but share with my audience some of the sort of pride and joy of some of their lawyers and how successful they have been in union busting. I mean, I would love to know, is there one lawyer there who's helped the union? I don't think so.
On the website, they say that, you know, they regularly counsel and train clients on union avoidance, employee terminations, arbitration and contract administration and interpretation. One of the lawyers there, you know, says in his bio that he defeated a labor union bid for recognition as the collective bargaining representative after advising and coordinating the employer's 5-month anti-union campaign. It's fairly difficult to actually track what this firm is doing. And, you know, one thing I'll even flag here is Kamala Harris's husband, Doug Emhoff, used to work for Venable too in Los Angeles. It's a fairly known entity in politics, this firm.
It's not just that Tom Perez is working for the firm, but when you look at the history of the firm, from what little we can tell, because there's so little transparency, what we can tell you, because they're boasting about it, is that they are really effective at union busting. Fabulous piece, Andrew. Very depressing piece. Andrew lives in Maine and is an activist who is a writer. The title of his piece, Obama Labor Secretary Tom Perez just joined an anti-union law firm. And again, I have to go with that little kernel that you have in the beginning of your piece. Former DNC chair and Obama Labor Secretary Tom Perez just joined a law firm that brags about its lawyers who regularly counsel and train clients on union avoidance. Thank you so much, Mr. Perez. Join me again soon.
Absolutely.
That was Arnie Arneson speaking to Andrew Perez at WNHNLP in Concord, New Hampshire. The full interview is available at www.wnhnfm.org under the programs link. This is Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Vinisha Patel Adams. Workers in Namibia on Africa's southern Atlantic coast are facing not only the COVID pandemic, but also an attack on their union, the Mine Workers Union of Namibia. Last September, China National Nuclear Corporation, the owner of the Rossing uranium mine, fired the entire 9-member union leadership when they refused to concede their healthcare benefits and opposed the import of Chinese workers to replace Namibian workers.
Are you tired?
No.
Comrade,
no. No.
Are you tired?
No.
Comrade,
no. No.
My name is Johannes. I'm Tenya. Important to note is that whenever there was, with Rio Tinto, whenever there was dispute, whenever there was misunderstanding between the two parties, the parties will convene meetings because there is a dispute procedure provided for in our procedural agreement. Parties will convene meeting and resolve these issues without that one party basically abusing their power and directly attacking the other parties. But with the Chinese, they don't want to resolve. They don't want to come to the table. What they do, they rather send you threat letters. And this is what they've been doing. In fact, one of the things that they've done, the first thing they did is try to bribe. On several occasions, they tried to bribe me personally. That's the general manager of organizational resources. Basically, offered me a number of bribes, and I rejected all that.
What kind of bribes did he offer?
He offered me promotion. He offered to buy my sister a car, to send my sister to China for studies, political advancement, and all that. I had all that on the recording. Basically, then during the COVID-19, before COVID-19, when he sent us the first threat letters, as the leadership, we then decided to expose him. We were busy exposing him. We crafted the letter that was to send to the board of directors. But then we think our letter that we were about to send to the board of directors was intercepted by them. So with the interception of that letter, they then send this particular man that was mentioned in that letter, the one who was threatening us, they send him on indefinite leave. So COVID-19 came, my device basically broke. And after my device broke, and then at the same time, we were suspended and ultimately charged and dismissed. So most of these things were downloaded on the Rosing system. So with us being outside, all those information, all that proof, basically, then lost it.
How was COVID affected workers at the mine? Are the Chinese testing all the workers? Do you have tests for COVID? How are they treating you?
No, not good at all. In fact, we had written a lot of letters to them regarding this COVID. So what the Chinese did when COVID came, they removed themselves and started working from home. But our workers remained. And strictly, the workers were not allowed to speak about their status. People get removed from sites. And there was a lot of fears that was created. And the workers were not allowed to disclose their information to their colleagues. And secondly, they were denying the presence of COVID on site until it became obvious. People were even told not to tell anybody they're exposed to COVID. When they could not control this, then because people started, then they decided going forward, only Rosing doctors will test their patients. So that when result comes, this result is kept by them. So they'll just look at the result and then keep it. And then they'll just keep that person outside and treat him, but they don't tell him what is he sick of. So these are the complaints. And even people are told to come back to work while still they are positive. And Ross, China, since they came, they've actually written us letters wanting to change the medical scheme that we currently have. The agreement that we have in Rossing pays 82%, and then we pay 18%. So this the 700 that I told you about, 82% of that is supposed to be paid by Rossing Uranium. And then the 18% we should then contribute. So since China came, they said this medical aid is too expensive. Now, this medical aid is too expensive. We want to do away with it. So they've been pushing. They wrote us letter. They brought in cheaper medical aid, trying to convince employees to basically then move over to the cheaper medical aid. So when we were there, we were not successful with that. So we heard now that they are pushing to make sure that this medical aid basically then takes over by at least end of December. So if an employee got sick, the medical aid then took care of his medical bills. One of the things they did was to, first of all, threaten us, send us threat letters. We have in our possession threat letters. When we replied to them to tell them, look, in terms of our legislations and our agreement, we have a right to represent the employees and take up this issue on their behalf. They realized they will not succeed with us. He tried to convene meetings, call them to come and meet and to talk about the issues. He did not succeed. They did not want to meet with us. I remember two meetings, and they just never showed up.
Comrades, enough is enough with exploitation of workers. Enough is enough with outsourcing of our work. If the management want to exploit workers, they must go back to where they came from and let our own people run crossing. We have enough mines and we have enough people with enough capacity in Namibia to run this organization. Viva workers, viva!
Viva!
Viva workers, viva!
Viva!
Teamsters Local 808 President Chris Silveira on the struggle of Namibian miners.
We need to actually be sending some letters to the Chinese embassy to say, wait a minute, if you are a communist government, how do you allow a company to be in Namibia treating people like this? Right? I thought you was a communist. What kind of communist are you? But you're really not a communist anymore. You done gave up on that. You just call yourself communist, but you ain't communist no more. You playing right along with Bezos and them, and you're all in the same party because this is a global movement to destroy the labor movement because it's the labor movement that keeps workers' wages up. And if they can destroy that by moving jobs in other places and destroying the foundations in Europe and the United States, we're all going to be in poverty wages in 20 years. So we need to have a channel that's bringing in information from South Africa, from Australia, from South Korea, from all over the world, so that workers here begin to understand, you ain't the only guy with a problem. Bezos is screwing me in France. This guy's screwing me in Namibia. This guy's screwing me over here. And when they understand that, then they're going to, the racism is going to fall to the wayside, because now they're going to see themselves as a part of the labor movement from a global perspective. And this doesn't happen until we globalize and make people begin to realize you're not in this by yourself.
The miners continue the fight to get their jobs back, while miners at three other Chinese-owned mines face similar attacks on their unions. Rebel Diaz performs Chicago Teachers Part Time.
Truly inspired. Here we go. Come on. Look. Yo. Yo. Homie, I was taught by Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher. So I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago teachers. Homie, I was taught by Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher. So I'm inspired.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy.
The role of the AFL-CIO internationally is extensive. Today, they get over $30 million a year from the United States government-funded National Endowment for Democracy for their Solidarity Center. Pacifica producer Mammoth Barham looks at the history of the CIA and the U.S. government in funding and establishing corporate unions in Turkey.
Dağlara değil, çekmesin bir de demirden perde.
Imperialism, the AFL-CIO, and the unionization of the working class in Turkey. There was a time back in the 1940s to 1980s in Turkey when it was not acceptable to get benefits or payments from a foreign country. Turkey's integration to imperialism was completed with the US-supported military coup in the 1980s. Then, receiving foreign funds became a source of pride and even a justification that finally Turkish institutions were being recognized by the world and the funds were good-intentioned, only helping to manage the otherwise poorly run affairs. The paranoia and caution against imperialism gave way to acceptance. In this environment, those institutions, even the labor institutions, started to compete to get their hands on the money and benefits offered by the imperialists. However, there was a price to pay when one looks at it from the class perspective of the labor, the working classes, the poor masses. When Turkey decided to join NATO during the years when the working class started to develop under the newly formed capitalist structure, controls had to be established. Although the working class was still weak and very much under the control of the government, precautions were needed as the rulers didn't want to take any risks of an independent labor movement. In the 1950s, the US entered Turkey in many fields, showering it with funds to provide the infrastructure to move it rapidly along the capitalist line. Since both capitalism and the working classes were weak and the nationalist ideology was dominant, the US had to ensure that the capitalist path would not be abandoned along the way. Those years, right after the Second World War, the Cold War against communism had started, and the US was willing to invest in countries to prevent communism, which was sounding attractive to the world's working classes. These were the years when a new labor union movement was fomenting in Turkey. The last of the non-communists were eliminated from the workers' movements and unions in 1946. That is why initially the US did not bother to get involved in the initial union formations of the time. There was no need for the US to be concerned since the government, the opposition, and even the government-controlled Turkish Labor Federation were all very anti-communist and pro-US. the government-controlled Confederation of Labor Unions, Turkish, was formed to gather all unions under a controllable umbrella as suggested by the US labor leaders. The US's only attempt at this stage was to fly some labor leaders in this confederation to the US to educate and train them in the American way of organizing. However, to mitigate any risks that may emerge in the future and to show alternative methods of control, Boris Shishkin of the AFL was sent to Turkey on January of 1951. Shishkin came to Turkey with a proposal to establish an anti-communist labor confederation and for this new confederation to join the very anti-communist ICFTU, the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions. Thus, Turkish Confederation was born. After Boris Shishkin's visit, Erwin Brown, working for the CIA, started his visits and work on making sure that the trade union work stayed anti-communist and pro-US in Turkey. Erwin Brown worked like a diplomat assigned to Turkey by the US government. This is because the US used this labor movement as one of its tools of foreign policy. In his report about his visit to Turkey, Erwin Brown urged all Western unions to work and help Turkey become a NATO country. The investments of the US through labor movement had paid off to a degree when in every labor conflict and issue affecting politics, the pro-US Confederation has taken the side of the right wing and has damaged an independent left struggle of the working class in Turkey. It has always maintained its support for the fascist, right-wing Turkish governments, the military juntas, even when those governments and regimes have crushed the working classes.
Yollara değin, yollara değin, olsunlar yarım yarım, tez görsün kahrım.
In the troubled years between 1960 and 70, more than 600 Turkish unionists have been flown to the US to be trained, educated, and assessed by the AFL-CIO. These unionists have been used according to their abilities to further anti-working class politics disguised as beneficial to labor. Between 1960 and 1970, AID organization, which is the US's foreign policy and spying agency, gave Turkish 13.4 million Turkish liras. At that time, the entire income of Turkish was 13.5 million liras. So the AID agency was giving Turkish an equivalent of its entire income as grant. How could one claim this organization is an independent labor confederation when a foreign US policy implementation agency doubles its income, showering it with funds? However, it is important to note that the best laid out plans don't work the way they are intended to. The three of the Turkish officials flown off to the US, wined and dined there, and received training on how to betray the working class, finally had enough of this selling out, and split from the US-controlled Turkish to form the independent left Confederation of Revolutionary Labor Unions, or the Confederation of Progressive Labor Unions as its official name. Even recently, when the conditions were unacceptable to the working class and an agreement was reached to go on a general strike, at the last minute, Turkish, loyal to its tradition and American unionism, taught by the AFL-CIO bosses, pulled out in favor of the government and left the rest of the unions and confederations high and dry, effectively sabotaging the strike. This is Mehmet Bayrat reporting for Pacifica, COVID, Race and Democracy.
That was Mehmet Bayram of Pacifica, looking at the role of the AFL-CIO and the U.S. government in Turkey. Ethiopia is a nation of more than 112 million people, at the center of the geostrategically critical Horn of Africa. It has fallen out of favor with the U.S. foreign policy establishment since the 2018 uprising that overthrew the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front junta and put Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed in power. Pacifica's Anne Garrison reports.
I spoke to Los Angeles-based Ethiopian-American activist Binyam Kitau. What's the significance of the peace that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed negotiated to end the decades-long border conflict with Eritrea, and why has it been so upsetting to the U.S. foreign policy establishment?
Well, Isaias Afwerki is president of Eritrea, and one good thing that he's done for Eritrea is he's made it so that outside countries, namely the United States and the Western EU bloc, which includes UK, has virtually no influence. So peace is good, right? Like if the United States was at war with Canada or Mexico, that makes it very difficult for progress. So peace between Ethiopia and Eritrea and Somalia is always a good thing. And I think really the issue is that the United States or the UK or the EU didn't really have a hand in it. It wasn't something that they controlled. And so they don't like that. And that also means that it doesn't allow the United States government to control what peace entails between the two countries. One being AFRICOM. Eritrea has refused to participate or allow Western powers to put boots on the ground in Eritrea. And so in AFRICOM, this command base that's in the Horn of Africa, pretty much, you know, any major Western power can operate out of that base. But Eritrea's leadership has decided not to allow that, not to participate. And that upsets some of the previous colonial powers, as well as the United States. And Ethiopia needs peace right now. It's been a long time since Ethiopia has had peace.
Eritrea is the only African nation that refuses to collaborate with AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command, right?
Yes.
Okay. And Ethiopia was a partner of AFRICOM and the UN peacekeeping mission in Somalia, which has U.S. commanders. Do you think that will continue?
I'm not sure. And I think the United States government is probably nervous about that also. Whether Abiy Ahmed is in power or not, what the common Ethiopian wants is sovereignty so that Ethiopia can have some form of peace. And I think that's also why the TPLF was allowed to rule with the blessing of the Western powers for so long. So we don't know if Abiy Ahmed stays in power, will he allow, or the next leader still allow, United States military boots on the ground in Ethiopia? I don't know. It would be nice if there's some kind of peaceful agreement, but I think what's overwhelmingly agreed upon first between the Horn of Africa countries is peaceful agreements between the three countries involved, Somalia, Ethiopia, and Eritrea, and also sovereignty, the right to make decisions without foreign powers interfering from any angle. So we'll see.
You named three powers involved, yeah. Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia. Aren't there two other countries in the Horn, Djibouti and Kenya?
Well, yeah, Kenya has a historical friend to Ethiopia. The only time that I've seen any type of questionable behavior between Kenya and Ethiopia was a recent military agreement that was signed between Egypt and Kenya. But Kenya's been peaceful. Djibouti's been peaceful. There hasn't been a lot of conflict in comparison to the other three countries, especially Somalia and Ethiopia. And so this agreement between Ethiopia or Abiy Ahmed Farmajo of Somalia and Ethiopia, whether you like them or not, and I'm not pro-Abiy, it is a good thing. They're trying to figure out how to have some kind of collective agreement to peace, collective agreement to shared economies. It's a very good thing.
But this likely upsets the U.S. foreign policy establishment to see three African nations in the Horn coming together to chart an independent path?
I firmly agree with that. And I think the behavior of Secretary Blinken and probably this new guy on the scene, Jeffrey Feltman, confirms that. So they're kind of like the voices of an old voice in U.S. foreign policy, namely Susan Rice, who's not supposed to be involved in foreign policy, but it seems like everything she believes in is leaking back into the current time frame. So what I mean by that, for example, is during the Mullah Zenawi regime and then after him, we can talk about all kinds of ethnic atrocities. Actually, one of the people involved was Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who is the current World Health Organization chief. If Secretary Blinken and Jeffrey Feltman were so concerned about atrocities, ethnic cleansing, then they should be talking about how this was the historical record of the Mullah Zenawi and the TPLF regime, but they're not. They're focusing on what's happening in Tigray because they want their puppet government back. They want a government that they can control. So they're not really concerned about the innocent people. Now, what's scary about that is this seems to be a pattern. Everywhere the U.S. talks about helping with democracy, usually it ends up being a complete mess. I mean, we have a couple of really good examples in Syria and Iraq.
President Trump cut $100 million in aid to Ethiopia and threatened to arm Egypt to blow up the Grand Renaissance Dam, which is Ethiopia's project. And then the U.S. Congress censured the Ethiopian government recently over alleged atrocities in Tigray and imposed sanctions. How much is this hurting Ethiopia?
Well, the sanctions themselves at the moment aren't going to significantly hurt the common Ethiopian people. More the sanctions are targeted at the Ethiopian government members. It's more the funds. And this is one of the linchpins of the foreign policy. See, if the GERD is completed, which is the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, that means the Ethiopian nation will have a higher access to electricity, which means that Ethiopia as a nation will become more economically self-sufficient and be a contender as an economic power to Egypt. And that's really what Egypt is really angry about. They don't want another economic power in the region. And it appears that the U.S. is trying to help Egypt in that aim, to keep Ethiopia aid dependent, and instead of allowing Ethiopia to become economically self-sufficient.
Okay, U.S. hostilities to both Ethiopia and Eritrea have been undeniably similar to those preceding the U.S.-NATO wars in Libya and Syria. And some people have told me that Ethiopians and Eritreans are preparing for the possibility of direct U.S. military aggression or aggression by a U.S.-armed regional proxy force, most likely Egypt or a multinational force led by Egypt. Do you think those preparations are warranted?
By the Ethiopian and Eritrean people? Absolutely. My guess is the U.S. is going to keep tightening the noose from a sanction perspective and from an economic perspective. And they've already granted Egypt more military aid. I think it was just about a month ago. And so it would be easier for the U.S. to use some kind of Egypt-backed force to impose what the United States government wants than putting American boots on the ground. But there seems to be very clearly an agenda where the U.S. just doesn't want a government or the Ethiopian and Eritrean people to have true sovereignty. And this is really, besides the GERD, the main point of contention, which I don't understand. It would actually be much easier for the U.S. government to just try to work with the powers that exist, because what Ethiopia will do to balance, and which is already happening, they're in talks with Russia and China, and that they have been developing deeper relationships with China. And the Russian relationship has been going back probably about 140 years. There's been diplomatic relations between Russia and Ethiopia for about 140 years. And so, you know, Russia is going to continue to be a big power, and that'll just push Ethiopia towards that way, instead of United States government and the UK bloc, Western EU bloc, just making friends and figuring out how to come to some kind of happy compromise.
So if the US is aggressive, the aggression will push Ethiopia and its allies closer to Russia and China.
Absolutely. And Ethiopia is not a pushover. Ethiopia may not be militarily as strong as, you know, UK, United States, but Ethiopia has a very well-established history of defending its sovereignty very, very effectively. And so if the United States in some form of fashion, whether it's through Egypt or through a NATO force or whatever, invades, it's not going to go the way they think it's going to go. It's going to be messy and ugly, and the Ethiopians are going to dig in, because the Ethiopians enjoy a proud history of sovereignty and independence. So it would be nicer. I wish the US-UK Western bloc of the EU would just try to, you know, be okay with Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia having sovereignty and work with them, even if it's temporarily until the next guy is in power after Abiy Ahmed or after Isaias. You know, there could be temporary solutions in there, but those countries are not going to take military aggression lightly. And the historical pattern is it doesn't usually go in the favor of the invading power. So there you go.
Well, this new U.S. special envoy to the Horn, Jeffrey Feltman, said that Ethiopia would make Syria look like a picnic.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a smart guy. I think just he's not going to get what he's trying to push for. It seems him specifically, maybe more so than anybody else, really wants the TPLF regime back in power. And that's just not happening. The Ethiopian people will not allow that.
And that was Binyam Kitau, Los Angeles-based Ethiopian-American activist. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Steve Zeltzer. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Palina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. I've been your host, Vinisha Patel-Adams. Thanks for listening. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.